The following podcast includes explicit language, including, well, you'll just have to wait and see.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine, and this is Hang Up and Listen for the week of March 11th, 2024. On this week's show, we'll talk about the early arrival of March Madness as a fight broke out between the LSU and South Carolina women's basketball teams. We'll also discuss Steve Garvey's Senate candidacy, Emmett Smith's outrage at the University of Florida's move to fire its DEI employees, and other ways that sports and politics are intersecting in 2024. I'm in Washington, D.C. I'm the author of the book The Queen, and the host of an upcoming slow burn season on the rise of Fox News and how the left tried to fight back. Also in D.C. is Stefan Fatsis. He's the author of the books Word Freak, Wild and Outside, and A Few Seconds of Panic, a book that highlights a tenure with the Denver Broncos that was in so many ways more productive than Russell Wilson's. Hello, Stefan.
I think that is exactly correct.
Add that to the jacket copy. With us from Palo Alto is Slate writer, podcaster, and sports combat enthusiast Joel Anderson. Excited to discuss some light fisticuffs with you, Joel.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I do like to talk about fights. So, yeah, good for me. Also, I just have to note before we bring in our next guest, I'm even further down the line here. I'm the only person that's never published a book.
As of today, I mean, you could, like, get on your horse and do one by tomorrow.
I mean, I've got an outline due for a story that I haven't finished yet, so I doubt it, but we'll see.
I believe in you. And joining us today, finally, I'm thrilled to report, is one of our favorite people. Vincent Cunningham is a staff writer and theater critic at The New Yorker, the co-host of their Critics at Large podcast as well. He's also the author of Great Expectations. If Miss Havisham shows up in a wedding dress, you might have the wrong version. but it's a novel based in part on his experience working on Barack Obama's 2008 campaign. It's out this Tuesday, March the 12th. And Slate's own Laura Miller calls it a sparkling debut that earns its comparisons to Henry James. Vincent, we are so thrilled to have you here and to be celebrating this moment with you. I think I can see you sparkling, though that might just be a faulty internet connection.
Well, that's just the Colgate guarantee, Josh. That's what you call that. Thank you, guys. It's, of course, so cool to be here with you. I can't wait to talk more. I mean, chiefly about myself, but also about basketball and other drugs.
We want to thank our Slate Plus members for making this show possible. And this week, we've got a bonus segment, and we've got Vincent in the bonus segment. And Vincent, I think since you're here, got to do the Knicks. Got to do the Knicks and their explosive high-scoring offense.
Oh, my gosh.
But we'll save it for the bonus segment. If you want to hear that and bonus segments on other Slate shows and get ad-free listening for all Slate podcasts and support us, you need to be a member. To sign up, go to slate.com/hangupplus. That's slate.com/hangupplus.
With about 2 minutes to go in the SEC women's basketball tournament final on Sunday between top-ranked South Carolina and number 8 LSU, all hell broke loose. With the Gamecocks up by 7, South Carolina guard Mileja Fulwiley stole the ball from LSU's Flauje Johnson. Let's let ESPN announcer Courtney Lyle take it from there.
Let's see what just happened again. Flauje Johnson holds on to Mileja Fulwiley. And then Flauje pushes Watkins. That's when Cardoso comes up and pushes Flauje down. Somebody jumped over the scorer's table from the stands.
Gamecocks, Gamecocks. Watkins is South Carolina forward Ashlyn Watkins, and Cardoso is South Carolina forward Camila Cardoso. And the somebody who jumped over the scorer's table from the stands was Flauje Johnson's brother, who pushed Cardoso in the back, before getting hauled away by a cop. It took about 15 minutes to sort things out. Cardoso and every player who wasn't in the game except for one were ejected. South Carolina won 79-72 to continue its undefeated season, and everyone apologized after the game for their behavior. Vincent, all I can say is that if there's any sports justice, we'll get a rematch in a few weeks in the NCAA tournament.
It's absolutely incredible. And yes, I want to see this. And it's such a blessing because before all of this, I think most college women's basketball fans were waiting for the rerun of LSU-Iowa to see Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark go ahead. But all of a sudden, this looks amazing. Even before this fight happened, I don't know if you guys saw this clip. It's Cardoso and Angel Reese fighting for position in the paint, just kind of bumping against each other, pushing. And Cardoso has this absolutely, like, homicidal smile on the whole time. And Angel Reese is talking shit to her. It's just like,
I'm going
to
be here all day.
I'm going to be here all day. It was just, like, such a joy of the fight. I hope that people don't let this fight be a sort of defacing element and just let it really be the sign of enthusiasm that it should be. I mean, there was a play in there where Angel Reese grabs Cardoso's hair. Like, these guys are so intent in this budding rivalry, and it's just another sign that women's college basketball is where the heat is in so-called amateur sports.
Joel, how big was your smile compared to Camila Cardoso's?
Well, you know, I've always long thought basketball is more enjoyable when there's when there's the risk of a little, you know, physicality. You know, I feel like, you know, basketball, like, for as much as we enjoy the skill and the finesse and, you know, just like the beautiful parts of the game, you know, the passes, you know, the pick and rolls, the alley-oops, all that sort of stuff. I mean, the thing that...
Is your favorite basketball player ever Julius Peppers?
You know, him or Anthony Gonzalez, it's one of the two. Or Antonio Gates, I guess, too, if you had to, you know, but I just think, though, that, like, the one thing, and it might help everybody, because I think that there's a lot of frustration with this era of basketball, because it's like, you know, a lot of the people taking threes, we have an all-star game where they only called three fouls, so there's just not a lot of physical contact with basketball anymore. And I feel like this is almost sort of the perfect, like, just a little seasoning, just a little bit of, like, animus and anger and physicality and elbows. It's the kind of stuff that I grew up with basketball, and I think all of us sort of did. And, you know, for me, Stefan, I was kind of, you know, it kind of jazzed me a little bit. I was like, okay, it's good to see this back in the game.
And it's coming at the perfect time, like, as Stefan alluded to in his intro, it's right before, you know, the NCAA tournament, and there could be a potential rematch. And like you said, Vincent, LSU and South Carolina were pointing towards each other in the tournament last year. Iowa kind of spoiled the party by upsetting South Carolina in the Final Four. And so...
Wait, Josh.
Yeah, what's that, Joel?
Is the LSU fan... Do you agree with my theory, then, that LSU sort of got unsettled down the stretch because they know that they won South Carolina's championship last year?
banners fly forever. No, I mean, if LSU won South Carolina's championship, that should rankle South Carolina, not LSU, that they know that they blew it, that they had the better team. And in the regular season, South Carolina has had the superior team, including earlier this year. It's a great rivalry. The coaches are the biggest personalities in the women's game. The South Carolina team, how they reloaded after losing five WNBA draft picks. And their team is just incredibly deep and talented. I mean, Phil Wiley, who you mentioned, Stefan, is one of the most exciting players in the entire sport and comes off the bench. And Cardoso, I mean, there was a clip that was circulating. I didn't know about this, and I don't know if you guys saw it, but she had taken some time off to play in the World Championships. She had, like, left South Carolina to play for Brazil to try to get them to qualify for the Olympics, rather. And she was pushing a woman down in Olympic qualifying. So she's, you know, got some spice to her as well. And what a weekend for her, banking in a three to win the previous game against Tennessee.
The first three of her career.
The first of her career. And so I'm saying a lot of things here, Stefan, but I think it all comes back to what Vincent said, which is that this sport has so much juice right now. We haven't even talked about Iowa's overtime win in the Big Ten championship. The players are the same that we got to know last year. The teams are kind of the same. The coaches are the same. And it's just building. It's kind of realizing what we all were speculating about last year, that the sport just keeps rising and growing. And it doesn't seem like there's any reason to believe that like this won't be the most popular NCAA tournament ever.
And the difference between the women's game right now and the men's college game is that we know all of these names. We know these women's personalities. We know their styles on the court. You'd be hard-pressed to put together a list of men's college basketball players who have the same juice. And I'm willing to bet the same kind of NIL sponsorship endorsement juice.
That we did have Kyle Filipowski cosplaying as Grayson Allen. So that was helpful.
That was like an attempt to get his name recognition up, right?
And I've heard of Rob Dillingham. So he was in a Drake video recently or something like that. So there's that.
I mean, Cardoso, who is one of the lesser known players at the upper echelon of the game, maybe because she's like a 6'7" forward. This is a woman that hit this game-winning three suddenly because she goes in and gets herself involved in this fight. Her name recognition is way up. She's going to miss the first round of the NCAA tournament. That should not be a problem for South Carolina. You mentioned Caitlin Clark, who is a million-dollar-plus player at this point, who has declared to go to the NBA next season, passing up a potential fifth year at Iowa. Paige Beckers, who was the player we thought would become Caitlin Clark, is going to stay at UConn for one more year. There are just names up and down the women's game that are going to make this tournament by far the most watched, I think, in women's sports history.
That's a really interesting thing you just said about like the concurrence of the sort of the rise of women's basketball on the collegiate level on the one hand and NIL on the other. Something like the men's game, it seems like there's a story of decline that has to do with like superstar athletes going after money, the one and done being making a lack of continuity on and on. Whereas it seems like NIL and women college basketball weirdly are friends, that there's even more incentive now to stick around if you're one of the best players.
Yeah, you're gonna make more money, Vincent, playing college basketball than you are in the WNBA.
That's right. It just seems like there's the way the tectonics are set right now, that this is something that's going to be lasting instead of kind of a flash in the pan thing.
What you said, Stefan, is not quite true and is often like used as a cudgel against the WNBA. Caitlin Clark is going to keep all of her endorsements.
Oh, sure.
On the flip side, in men's college basketball, you have players like Oscar Tshiebwe, like recent National Player of the Year, who came back to play at Kentucky because he doesn't have the same kind of pro potential. So, and, you know, Joel did his after ball on G League Ignite about how NIL and the rise of it in the men's college game has threatened the NBA's like preferred developmental pathway. So there's a lot of like kind of interesting and confounding and many ways things going on here.
Yeah, and I think one thing that'll help, Duke played UNC this weekend, and actually it's funny, and I know my boy Decker is listening, he texted me over the weekend, he's like, dog, none of us were watching Duke versus UNC over the weekend, but the whole timeline checked in for South Carolina, right? And obviously that's overstating it a bit, but I kind of forgot that Duke was playing UNC until it came on TV on Saturday night. Which is interesting, but I do think that the men's game does have a chance. Like, I don't know how long Armando Bacot's been at UNC, but it feels like he may have played with, Todd Lawson or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, I was just like, man, that guy's been power forward at UNC for a while. And I do think that, like, maybe the women's game is going to show, at least for some men, because even at the end of the day, even when we're talking about one for done, we're really talking about, like, three or four people that college basketball fans don't even really get a chance to know, right? So there's still a chance, I think, for men's college basketball to sort of follow the example of women's college basketball. These guys will stay longer. They get to see the benefits of being on campus one place for three or more years, and they'll build their names. And so, like, I actually think that there's a little bit more hope for the men's game. But, yeah, I mean, for right now, I mean, like you all. I mean, did you all watch the Duke UNC game, or did you? Were you more excited by the LSU South Carolina game?
I was actually at the UVA Georgia Tech game. I happened to be in Charlottesville this weekend, that's, and the people I was terrible. Hanging out with had that's an extra ticket.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But I mean, I want to go back to what you said, Josh, because I think the difference here is that A, you can't declare early for the WNBA. You've got to be 22 or have completed, what, 4 years of eligibility?
I think three.
3 years of eligibility. And the other difference is that what NIL has done for women has elevated their profiles. It is much more targeted in a professional way that endorsers want the women that will actually benefit their brands. With the men, it's, are you a good basketball player? And can our collective pay you enough to get you to come to our school so that you can make the team better? And that's a distinction that, and I think it's a benefit for the women's game right now in terms of creating these marketable names and players that people want to tune in and watch.
Let me just say this about Angel Reese and to some extent, Kim Mulkey. I mean, after the game, they were like cutting promos. I mean, The way that they have been able to bring attention to their team and their sport to popularize it, I think, is undeniable. I mean, Kim Mulkey saying that she wished that Cardoso had pushed Angel Reese instead of Flajay Johnson. Angel Reese talking about how they're not afraid of South Carolina and basically that they just want more smoke in the tournament. And I think I'm going to talk a little bit about the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team in a bit. But that sport and those athletes have, I think, benefited and in some ways been circumscribed by this idea that they are, you know, representing a social cause, that they're role models, that they're out there like representing for, you know, little girls everywhere. And what I think this, you know, Caitlin, Angel, you know, Juju Watkins, we need to throw her in there as well. What they're doing is that You've got, Vincent, this whole trend of like the people wearing everyone watches women's sports t-shirt. Like there is the kind of cause aspect to it, but there's also the like, we're going to pull, you know, we're going to punch each other. We just want to beat the shit out of each other. We are going to talk smack about each other. And we're going to like do all of the like the things that we would watch any game. And so there is a kind of ramp up or effect. So we watch these games for like eight different reasons. It's not just, you know, one reason or because we want to support, you know, women playing a game because it's just like a good thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, a star to me, you know, it's Caitlin Clark is amazing at basketball and that is worth all of the attention that it has brought to the game. But once you get into this level, when it's sort of stars are being made, there is no star to me like Angel Reese, like almost in the world. She's like, she has one of those faces and one of the, it's like, she is the most lip-readingable person I've ever thought. Like, you can see her talking to her teammates, to other people, and you know exactly what she's saying and the exact emphasis that she's saying with it. There's just something to be said for, okay, attention comes, and then once the attention comes, you can start to notice these fine distinctions of, like, who's the coolest college basketball player? And that is Angel Reese, you know? And her plus the sort of, you know, sparkly jackets of Kim Mulkey, there just is a kind of magic that we haven't seen since, you know, certain Coach K coach teams. And it just, like, the personality mix is so amazing. And it's not to say that this is new, but it's just to say that the renewed scrutiny helps us to identify these people. And I think it's less that they're sort of acting in a certain way to sort of perpetuate an image or anything, but to say, here's a team with great star power, and now we're all able to see it. You know, I think Angel Reese is going to be cutting promo ads for the rest of her life. She's just like, she's amazing at basketball, but she's also just a star in the way that like Charles Barkley was, and we all knew it while he was playing.
I was wondering, would it be like if Angel Reese played for Dawn Staley? And I said this during the game, that Dawn Staley's teams reminded me a lot of the horror paranoia era, where like she's sort of the John Thompson of her era, and her teams are, you know, sort of, I mean, they have stars. I mean, they just had Aaliyah Boston, you know, the WNBA Rookie of the Year on their team. But they're a lot more, it's like a platoon level of team. You know, it's like not very many people break through. Nobody is going to, you know.
Cardoso plays like 25 minutes a game.
Yeah, right. Like, there's nobody's going to average 30 points a game or anything like that. And the reason I say this is because, so after that game and after the fight, immediately so, Don Staley was immediately apologetic about what had happened and, like, took great pains to even praise the LSU players in the middle of that. And I thought about, like, even though we're talking about how cool it is that, you know, that there was a little bit of heat and Angel Reese is, you know, kind of a shit talker supreme. Remember last year after South Carolina lost in the semifinal to Iowa and Don Staley was extremely upset and talked about the heightened sensitivity about the negative stereotypes when talking about black players and their behavior on the court, where she said, you know, people talked about that they play like they were in a bar fight and all this other stuff. And she was really, really upset about that, right? And so as much as I do love the Angel Reese stuff, I also think that when the time comes, Angel Reese is going to be on her own. You know, like if this sort of thing happens again, if she develops a reputation as a dirty player or a shit talker or whatever, I wonder what it's going to be like when it's not Don Staley running cover for you and it's a coach who has shown that she's not necessarily down to support her players and when times get hard.
I don't know about that, because Angel Reese got a huge amount of heat after the national championship last year, like especially in contrast to, you know, the white superstar Caitlin Clark, and it doesn't seem like she's been left on her own by her team or her coach.
Well, I was also referring more back to Brittany Griner too, but yes, you're right. But there was a reason that we thought there was some dissension in Baton Rouge earlier this year, in part between Angel Reese and Kim Mulkey, right? And so I don't know. Like, I mean, you may be.
It'll
right.
be interesting to. I mean, it'll be fascinating to see. Like, I don't think the Kim Mulkey, Angel Reese, LSU era will go out without one more big moment of some kind, or another. And I'm fascinated to see what that moment is. Up next, we're going to talk about sports and politics in 2024. One of the stranger political stories of the year, and there's a lot of competition, is the candidacy of Steve Garvey. Those of us who grew up in the 80s, also those of us who grew up in the 70s, will remember him as a well-scrubbed first baseman for the Dodgers and the Padres. And now, after having no political experience, he is the Republican nominee for Senate in California. He's going to be going up against Adam Schiff, a.k.a. losing to Adam Schiff, in the general election in November, despite having not really campaigned at all and not really talking about anything except for the fact that what he was feeling when he finished in second place was akin to hitting a walk-off home run, kind of like San Diego in 1984, he told his supporters on Tuesday night. Vincent, Adam Schiff kind of like engineered this, like spending more than $10 million in what his opponent, Katie Porter, was very upset about and kind of referred to as dirty pool, in an attempt to clear the field of other Democrats and face the baseball player, the Republican baseball player, in the general election. I'm trying to think about whether there's anything kind of significant or telling in this story. And as somebody who has worked on campaigns, who just wrote a novel, Great Expectations, out on Tuesday, that's about someone working on a political campaign, does this strike you as something that has analogs in our modern political life? Do you make kind of connections to things you've seen or experienced, or does it seem like sui generis to you?
It seems, of course, there are corollaries to make. Athletes have made that jump before. There's something to be said about, like, just like with Obama, there are these moments of sort of less personal qualities as the lead in a sort of in a political context, and more something about a kind of set of symbols, right? And the clean cut, well scrubbed baseball player maybe it's a relic of a bygone era, but it still means something, you know. The San Francisco Chronicle called called Steve Garvey's campaign Seinfeld-esque, a campaign about nothing. And if you watch him speak, it really is about nothing. But for people that watched the Oscars yesterday, it's like it can't help but dawn on you, like the biggest movie stars increasingly, or maybe just biggest stars, are, you know, John Cena and The Rock played a huge part in the Oscars yesterday. There is, I think, a growing thing of people from these other spheres making their way into politics. So I think it means something. But in this case, the story really is more about Adam Schiff, who, like, I think identified the nothingness of Garvey and maneuvered his way. I thought that those Katie Porter comments were pretty bad.
She called the election rigged.
Yeah, pretty bad. And she has declined to take it all the way back. And I'm very disappointed by that, just because of all that we know about sort of what it means in 2024 to call an election rigged. What happened is somebody did politics. I was disappointed with that. But Garvey, like, he resists meaning. He is a sinkhole for meaning. I think it's really interesting, but I don't think it's going to land him in the Senate.
It's sort of interesting, right? Because I feel like there was a time in life when Steve Garvey was a fairly prominent baseball player. Like, if you go back 40, 45 years, am I making that up, Stefan?
You're waiting for the old guy to jump in here?
The reason I say this, and this is going to sound crazy, you know, I think I've mentioned here before that my mom used to just buy me athlete autobiographies and memoirs as a kid to encourage me to read. One of the ones I read was Steve Garvey I was really young. And I don't remember anything about it, which is, you know, probably the same that anybody would say that anybody heard him speak recently, right? I don't remember what he said. I don't remember anything in particular. But like, he's sort of been famous for a while. And actually, Vincent, one of the things that sort of occurred to me just thinking about this is, like, there was this idea that Barack Obama was a political celebrity. And in some ways, wasn't he, like, sort of diminished by the idea that he was an interloper at that level of national politics? Like, he hasn't spent enough time doing this. He's a newbie. Like, this guy's just a celebrity. But, like, on the other hand, we've got people running real live celebrities. And hell, Josh, we had on Bill Bradley, and I didn't realize he had never been in a political office until he won for and ran his Senate seat in 1979. Like, this is a tradition that goes back a ways. But Vincent, like, I'm sure you all dealt with that a lot. Like, the idea that there was real no substance to Barack, that he just was, you know, coasting on his 2004 DNC speech, right?
That's right. And at the time, it's so weird. Like, it was sort of problematized in this moral way. Like, if we open the floodgates for this, it'll be XXX later on. Now, that argument, I don't know if it's helped or hurt by the fact that Trump came after Obama. But, this country elected Ronald Reagan, a sort of okay actor. You know, this is very much baked into our political DNA to sort of pluck people out of positions of prominence. You know, it used to be a commonplace to say that if Derek Jeter wanted to be the senator from New York, he could, you know, overturn the New York political scene, you know, in a second. And I think that's probably
true. If Drew Brees wanted to be mayor of New Orleans, he'd win in a landslide. I mean, these things are said,
right,
like, every week in every city about whoever is at the top in that place.
And very often they do run, right? There's your J.C. Wattses and other athletes that have gone on to careers in Congress or the Senate.
Herschel Walker tried. You know what I mean?
Well, there's a senator from Alabama right now who was a football coach. Steve Garvey kind of fits that mold. I mean, as a player, and I do remember Steve Garvey as a player because that was sort of my peak fan years, he was a terrific first baseman, really good first baseman for the Dodgers. In those years when they played the Yankees in the World Series multiple times. Tommy Lasorda was the manager. The Dodgers had Ron Say and Bill Russell. There was a great team. And Garvey's reputation was this clean-cut, all-American boy next door. And it was all belied by his real life. His wife, Cindy Garvey, would write a memoir a few years later after his career ended, accusing Garvey of abuse, of neglecting their children, of having affairs.
Did your mom buy you that one, Joel?
See, that's the thing. I was totally confused because he, you know, held himself out as, like, this, you know, this guy with a lot of this moral rectitude or whatever.
Squeaky
and then later,
clean,
I was
right?
like, oh, wait, that this I thought there were multiple Steve Garveys. I couldn't reconcile that was the same guy whose book I'd read. Yeah.
Well, and his reputation that came out later was that his teammates hated him. Nobody liked Steve Garvey. So perfect guy to be running for the Senate with zero experience, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's there's a way that like a superficially like handsome looking baseball first baseman is like a Make America Great Again kind of callback for a certain demographic that does not predominate in the state of California. But it reminds me of like a campaign that would be waged in like the 50s or 60s. There is something just like so out of time that's happening here, which makes it both fascinating and strange. But, you know, I know we also wanted to get to what's happening in Florida, Joel, with DEI. The University of Florida just fired all of its employees working in diversity, equity, and inclusion because of, you know, Ron DeSantis's legislative moves in that state. And Emmett Smith, of all people, the Florida great, came out and spoke out. I think he's been definitely the most prominent athlete, maybe the most prominent person to speak out against what's happening in Florida and against what's happening at the University of Florida. And we've talked about this on the show a couple of times. And so I'm just curious for your response to all of that, Joel.
Yeah, no, I mean that, you know, Emmett Smith, who, as far as I know, has mostly been apolitical throughout his career. Like I've never, you know, I lived in Dallas and Fort Worth towards the end of Emmett Smith's career with the Cowboys, even had the chance to cover him a little bit. And I can never remember him injecting himself into politics in this way before, which I think speaks to what's happening in Florida. But also, I'm pleasantly surprised that Emmett spoke up and a little disappointed that there hasn't been followed by like Jacquez Green or Ike Hilliard or, you know what I mean? You know, other people that
do you think Jacquez Green is like mad about being called out or happy that he was the first University of Florida athlete that came to mind?
Well, you know, the reason, because Jacquez Green and I follow each other and he's kind of said some stuff around the edges. He's a high school coach in Sarasota, Florida. And he's kind of said some stuff around the edges. And maybe the thing is that he's not famous enough anymore for his word to really ring out in that way. But
anymore?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, still.
But let me just read this, Joel. To the many minority athletes at University of Florida, please be aware and vocal about the decision by the university, who is now closing the doors on other minorities without any oversight. And to those who think it's not your problem and stay on the sidelines and say nothing, you are complicit in supporting systemic issues, says Emmett Smith.
Yeah, I mean, it's happening all throughout the South. And so it's not like Florida is the only state that is pursuing these anti-DEI initiatives. So he's right in that way, that like if you're in Texas, if you're in Oklahoma, if you're in Alabama, if you're in Georgia, and presumably, you know, Louisiana, Mississippi, a bunch of other states are going to follow suit, it is going to come to you. And I think one of the things that is useful here with Emmett speaking out is that, hey, man, we can make an example of one school really early. And then they may see, maybe we either can reconsider this or there's some other sort of way to mute the effects of these initiatives, right? Where maybe the schools will say, well, hey, look, we're still committed to diversity. We just can't do it through a DEI program. But, you know, I think the momentum around these bills is that is such that it's not going to be limited to Florida. And either, you know, people are just going to lay down across the South and allow this stuff to happen, or maybe there's one tactic, and this is just one of the things that I've been suggesting over the last couple of years, that, you know, recruiting former athletes, politicians like Randall Woodfin, the Birmingham mayor, whoever, to speak out against this stuff, because I do think that they can have some impact, right? I don't think I'm stupid by thinking that people speaking out, like, something could happen, right?
Well, doesn't it become a little bit of a tug of war, Vincent, between people like Emmett Smith, alumni, the mayor of Birmingham, you mentioned Randall Woodfin, who last week said to the parents of minority athletes who are helping their children decide if they want to play sports at those institutions, would you be cool with your child playing at schools where diversity among staff is actively being discouraged? On the other side, you've got very, very powerful people at these universities, namely the football coaches, going into impressionable 17-year-olds' living rooms and telling them why it'll be okay if you come to Alabama or Florida or Georgia or Louisiana to play Division I college football. That's a there are powerful interests at play here in terms of who's going to be sort of fighting for the minds and 4 years of college athletes.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think, I was trying to reason my way through why Emmett would speak up, which, as we mentioned, like, he has not been known to do. And I don't think it has to do with, like, a sort of, you know, if we pull back and think about national politics and how this issue of diversity has been mapped onto the red-blue grid, I don't think it's about Republican-Democrat politics per se. I think it's because of the regional nature of college football. And I think we all can put in our minds football programs who perennially have seemed like they don't really recruit black kids. Or like, or if they do, they're known as a more like sort of conservative campus. I think until very recently, we would think of like Ole Miss as like, you know, they do it a certain way down there.
Yeah, you know? Are you sure you want to go down there, my brother? Like, that's been the conversation.
Exactly.
With people going to Ole Miss for years. Yes,
that's right. And this affects the way that recruitment classes come together. All these things, and so I think the issue and why people are speaking up and why I think, Joel, you are right to think that this could work is because when all this whatever nationalized politics gets sort of can be shown to ramify onto things that people really care about, like recruitment, it's like it's going to change the way our university is seen by potential recruits. That is something that might change the mind of a booster, for example, who loves Ron DeSantis, thinks he's great, but all of a sudden something else that he cares about might change. I think that's a weird issue that sort of changes an axis that might put together some unlikely coalitions.
So, Josh, I mean, who's the first football coach or basketball coach in one of these states to come out and say, we oppose this and we want to still be able to recruit athletes and we understand their plight?
Could have been Jim Harbaugh, maybe. I mean, he's a guy who has, I mean, maybe not in the right state where this becomes an issue. But the intersection between coaches who would be outspoken on this issue and coaches who work in this geographic region is probably, I mean, there are rumors, right, that Deion Sanders is going to go to an SEC school at some point in the next few years. And that would certainly be an interesting convergence of fame, personality, political belief, and geography. But I can't think of anyone kind of off the top of my head. And maybe to kind of bring this home a little bit, and Vincent, I'll let you have the last word. It's like, you know, what just popped into my head is that, you know, Katie Britt is the politician who's kind of become the most famous given her bizarre State of the Union response. Her husband is an Alabama football player, former offensive lineman, who's like an All-American and played briefly in that NFL. And so even in places where sports, you don't think sports are there, sports are always fucking there everywhere in politics and our society. And kind of circling back to our first conversation, we're just in this moment when college athletes have an enormous amount of power. And so putting an issue like this on them is only an acknowledgement of that. Like, if athletes didn't go to Alabama en masse, black athletes, or Florida, that would not only make a big difference in those states, it would change how everyone in America kind of perceives this issue. But I guess the last question I have for you, Vincent, is there something fundamentally unfair, even as we acknowledge that it's true, about putting the weight of that on a 17-year-old or an 18-year-old and saying, kind of like Emmett Smith said here, if you don't do something, like not doing something is a choice, like, and just putting that weight and that burden on this small group of people as opposed to like everyone else in the country?
Well, you know, it's apocalyptic, I guess, in the sense that it like takes the sheet off of something, right? It is unfair because they're kids, and in this situation, people whose talents make them ripe for certain kinds of exploitation, it's unfair then to say you also need to be a sort of social justice superhero or whatever. But it just happened. When I say like it unveils something, I just means that it shows what kinds of power these people have always had. And I think all told, as a sort of 360 view, that is to the good. Like what you just said about how sports is always there, it's so funny to me. When people try to describe the class character of a Trump voter, they're like, actually, it's not all working class. It's like, it's a guy who owns a boat and a car dealership. I always want to like reach through the screen and say, you are describing the SEC. Do you know what I mean? Like the way to describe certain currents in our politics is best expressed through sports. And so if that becomes a little clearer, and if that means a different calculation for people who stand to make a lot of money, these kids, I don't think that that's bad, even if it does come with some added responsibilities. I think in the same way that NIL makes them understand their total stature a little bit better, I think it's to the good if they understand this aspect of their stature as well.
That was Vincent Cunningham. We're going to have you back for the bonus, but for the non-Slate Plus people, very few of them, I'm sure. we just want to give you a proper farewell here. And I want to note, Vincent, a couple of things that have been said about the book, Great Expectations. Ron Charles of The Washington Post calls it a coming-of-age story that captures the soul of America. The soul. That's an important part of America.
The soul.
The soul. He also says that no other recent American novelist, except perhaps Marilynne Robinson, she's pretty good, contends so diligently and so textually with the function of Christianity in the United States. And again, Slate's Laura Miller says that, Vincent, your prose rests like a cool hand on a fevered forehead. Can you reach through the Zoom right now? Give me some of that. I feel it.
Why didn't you read my tweets about Vincent's writing? I didn't publish an official review, but
all right. What are your tweets, Joel? Tell Vincent how you produce them.
Well, he knows. I tweeted them.
Tell Vincent how you feel about him. I just told him extemporaneously.
I mean, we can say you saw the tweet, Josh. Of course, we're praising him to his face here. I'm just really so jealous of Vincent as a writer. He really has a real knack for grace and like elegance that, for me, I find myself to be more of a mechanic, like as a writer, you know what I mean? And like, he just has like, you can see the art in the writing and it's just really beautiful. So like, I'm always sort of jealous of the very few people that can just touch this sort of level of art. I don't know how to explain it other than like just a person that is steeped in literature and art. And so, yeah, man, I'm just really happy for you, man. I can't wait to see the world respond to this book. So
more friends sent me your tweet than they did either any of those beautiful reviews.
Are you serious? So,
I swear to God, many of my friends follow you and they're all like, did you see what Joel Anderson? I was like, yeah, that's my boy. Thank you. First of all, this podcast is the cool hand on my fevered head.
Hell yeah.
I just want to clarify the valence of that, that soothing. Thank you guys for having me on, especially today. This is such a incredible, fun time. And nowhere would I have liked to sort of usher it in other than with you. Thank you guys so much. And thank you to any listener who decides to pick it up.
And now it is time for After Balls, sponsored by Bennett's Prune Juice, endorsed by Kenny Sailors, who says it was okay. The Iditarod Sled Dog Race reached Western Alaska on Sunday, capping a week that got a lot of attention because of a run-in between a moose and a musher. The musher was 5-time race winner Dallas Seavey, and the moose, well, the moose was unnamed, but is dead. Shot by Seavey after his dogs got tangled up with it on the trail. Iditarod mushers carry guns for just such an occasion. They're also required to stop the sled and gut an animal that they kill, in this case the moose, that is, remove its organs so that the meat can be salvaged. Race officials decided that Seavey did an inadequate job of gutting the moose. Racers who were following behind Seavey said that the moose was left in the trail and their dogs went over it like a speed bump. Bad form. At a rest stop, Seavey told reporters, and I'm quoting from an Alaska Public Media story, that he was mushing down a hill and around a blind corner when most of his team passed by the moose. He had to scramble to get his gun a .357 caliber revolver he keeps in a pouch at the top of his sled bag. I didn't get it out until the moose was all the way to the back of the team. Right about that time, I thought, this thing might just walk right by us. I mean, it was touching the dogs, CV said, and then all of a sudden, it just started kicking. CV shot the moose once at first, and the sound of the gunshot startled his dogs, causing them to lurch and pull the sled forward. Then he shot the moose four more times in the head, Alaska Public Media wrote, and it fell first on his sled, then in the middle of the trail. One of CV's dogs, Falu, was kicked by the moose and flown to the next checkpoint in Anchorage. That all happened earlier in the week. The update is that Falu, after some touch-and-go moments, is recovering comfortably at home, and CV made up his two-hour penalty and mushed into the last checkpoint on Sunday in first place.
Is there like a VAR for inadequate gutting? It seems very subjective.
You know, I think when you've got experts on staff in moose gutting, you get them out to the scene and they bring in the team. And, you know, these guys know what they're doing. I'm going to trust the moose gutting analysts here. I don't know that they
deference
needed
to authority.
Deference to authority. I'm not sure you needed to go to the replay in this case. Josh, what's your falu?
On Sunday at Snapdragon Stadium in San Diego, the U.S. women's national soccer team beat Brazil 1-0 on a Lindsey Horan goal, winning the inaugural Copa Ouro Feminina de la CONCACAF, that is, the CONCACAF Women's Gold Cup. It was a weird tournament for the U.S. in particular, starting with the women losing to Mexico 2-0 in the round-robin stage, just the second time in 43 matches that Eltree had beaten the U.S. Then in the semis, also at Snapdragon Stadium, the U.S. played Canada on what I believe were the worst field conditions ever in the history of sports, maybe minus the Iditarod. We're talking professional, amateur, backyard, whatever. As players from both teams tried and usually failed to navigate enormous pools of standing water in this land-based sport.
As Rodman can get in behind, nice heavy touches, but it just got stuck. And you just get the feeling that that will happen again and again tonight until we can see some semblance of drainage.
That feeling was, in fact, extremely accurate. It did happen again and again. The U.S. Scored a goal. Jaden Shaw scored a goal on a completely normal back pass from a Canadian player that just stuck in the ground. So that was fun. That game was bizarre. It was thrilling. It got tied up near the end of regulation, tied up again by Canada at the end of extra time. Because a listener punched a Canadian player in the face, not on purpose, which led to a penalty. Then Nair converted as a goalie a penalty kick in the penalties and stopped three from Canada. Exciting game. The final was less eventful, but it did lead me to have kind of two thoughts coming out of this tournament and coming out of the aftermath of the disappointing Women's World Cup for the U.S. team. There are really two criticisms of the team emerging after their failure to, they lost in the round of 16, a failure by the women's national team's standards. Critique number one, which came from the likes of former national team star Carly Lloyd, these players are like too interested in like getting paid equal amounts of money. They're like all into like social causes and stuff and just don't try as much as I, Carly Lloyd, used to try. Criticism number two, which is maybe less a criticism than an observation, is like, man, Spain seems like really good at soccer and like better than our players. That seems like maybe not a great trend. And like, there's all these, you know, leagues and clubs in these European countries, and they appear to be catching up and passing the U.S. Teams like Portugal that have no tradition in the women's game gave the U.S. an incredibly hard time. The Netherlands was passing it all around them. And it just seemed like the U.S. women from a technical level were falling behind. There's a new coach for the U.S. women's national team, Emma Hayes, who hasn't taken over yet. She's still with her club team, Chelsea, and will just have a little bit of time before the Olympics. In this tournament, they were led by an interim coach, Twyla Kilgore. And so this tournament was really the first chance to address those two questions, these two issues. Question number one, or kind of criticism number one, was always fake. It like never made any sense. And so to the extent that the U.S. women's national team refuted it in this tournament, which they did resoundingly, it never really needed to be refuted. But the way that they persevered in that match against Canada, the way that they played in those horrible field conditions, kind of didn't complain, were just like gutting out the win and just like, you know, sometimes the game plan goes out the window. You can't do anything resembling, whether it's because it's like negative 10 degrees on a football field, whether it's for whatever reason, you can't actually play the way you want to play. They persevered and won in those conditions against a team that's been a formidable opponent for them over the years. They also overcame a really dispiriting loss to Mexico, similar to some of the losses they had in the Women's World Cup, and fought through the adversity, were tough, and, you know, managed to make it through and put in, you know, a really good performance against Colombia in the quarters, really good performance, decent performance against Brazil in the finals. But, and then I'm curious for your thoughts on this, Stefan, on the second issue of whether the U.S. team has fallen behind the rest of the world, that to me, after watching this tournament, remains an extremely open question. There were moments in this tournament, especially in the quarterfinals against Colombia, where they played a very aggressive pressing style. They played kind of like American teams have tended to do in the past, using their speed, their athleticism, their toughness, and really like had Colombia completely flustered, took a huge lead, 3-0 lead going into halftime against a team that maybe was technically superior to them or was at least like a technical equivalent to them, but because of their spirit, because of their aggressiveness, because of their athleticism, were able to just completely destroy this team that had really great performances in the World Cup. And the final against Brazil, they were outplayed for a lot of the game, that they couldn't get out of their own half of the field. But, you know, these games come down to such small margins, that's why it's hard to make sweeping and dramatic conclusions based off one game or even one tournament. They got the win against Brazil. Lindsey Horan, as she did in the World Cup, came up with a huge play. There were a lot of young players, including Jaden Shaw, the 19-year-old who got the golden ball for the best player in the tournament, who, you know, demonstrated that there's a bright future, or at least there's a lot of up-and-coming players who are promising for this team. But again, Stefan, the kind of lingering question from the World Cup and going into the Olympics about, on a more macro level, is this team getting left behind or is the rest of the world getting caught up? The U.S. didn't answer that in a resounding way in this tournament.
No, zero. I mean, I think you can throw the Canada game out because it's impossible to draw any conclusions about ability given those conditions. I mean, it was kind of shocking to see. I know it rained a lot, but still, the drainage in this stadium, this is a new stadium, was appalling. I mean, how can there be standing puddles in a professional sports facility? I mean, there are giant squeegees for that shit, and there are good drainage systems to take care of that. It was really kind of shocking.
I mean, it called to mind the 2015 World Cup, where women were forced to play on artificial surfaces, which was in some ways an instigating event to the equal pay and equal treatment.
Yeah, and not just artificial surfaces, Joss, but just poor surfaces generally, even bad grass surfaces being booked in stadiums that just were not at the level that that fields would be for the men's team or other international teams.
Yeah, I mean, Joel, watching this game, and there wasn't a great explanation from CONCACAF for what happened here, but you just have to think that men of any sport or a men's game or that was this high profile would not have been allowed to have been played.
On the other hand, you know, games have been played in blizzards. There was one played in a blizzard earlier in the week in Major League Soccer, but this was different. This was definitely different. And there were conversations about whether the game should have been called off, and that was the ref's discretion.
We could probably think of a few examples of major male sports events where the playing surface has been terrible, but certainly nothing on the level of that. You know what I mean? Like that's unacceptable because you've got time. Also, you know, presumably you've got field, you know, groundskeepers, anything that could have been done to take care of that in advance. So yeah, that's unacceptable, man. I can't understand.
Yeah, the second half was a little bit better, but it still was not optimal. It was not actual soccer that you were watching. On the second question, Josh, can we take anything away from this and what does it all mean? I mean, it clearly, the United States has a deep bench of young players who show terrific promise. The difference now is that there are no walkovers the way there used to be. I mean, Mexico was an absolute joke. The sexism inside that federation and generally in that country toward women's soccer was high. And it prevented the sport from developing. Same goes for other countries. Spain, notably, the most notable among them. And Spain, in the matter of less than a decade, effectively reversed generations of exclusion to produce a World Cup champion, which was clearly the best team in that tournament. So I'm not sure it's that there is something, you know, you're going to read a lot about the structural problems with youth soccer in the United States and how European club-based systems are better for developing talent versus the college structure and pay for play here. And there's some truth in that for sure. But the one thing that hasn't changed is that we have the deepest pool of young soccer players in the world. There's no shortage of good coaches anymore. The main thing that has changed is that the pool of players in other countries is better and better and better. And it does make you wonder if there's a ceiling for the United States in terms of ability. How much better can they be than England or Spain or Colombia, Brazil, Mexico as they improve? And, you know, Brazil has been a team on the downswing. They were an early adopter of women's soccer. Colombia on the rise, Mexico on the rise, Spain, England, France, all in the last 15 years on the rise.
I mean, isn't it also, I mean, you know, the U.S. just lost a generation of great players that held it down for like, you know, 20-some-odd, you know, however long. And so they're just kind of trying to find their footing now, right? Like, I mean, it just could be that finding the right mix, finding the right coach, finding whatever is going to take some time. And that's, you know, sure the world caught up, but also like, I don't know. I mean, you soccer guys, you panic every time. Every time there's a loss. Oh, man, we need to reevaluate the women's
part of the sport.
The women's program or the men's program. You know, is America falling behind? I mean, I don't know. But I don't know. It seems to me that, like, maybe they just lost a lot of great players and they just need time to get their footing. But I could be wrong.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. And even the greatest soccer nations have golden generations and generations that aren't as talented. And there were teenagers that scored for the U.S. in this tournament. Jaden Shaw and Olivia Moultrie, Alyssa Thompson's another teenage star, Katerina Macario, who was going to be the star of the World Cup but had an ACL tear, is back playing for her club team now. There's just like a huge amount of attacking talent on this team. And so the Olympics are going to be fascinating. And the positive thing is that these games were entertaining and competitive. And finding quality competition in this hemisphere is a good thing for the U.S. Women in the long term.
Absolutely. And I think the big thing for Emma Hayes, the new coach, is going to be how quickly does she cycle completely through the past generation of players, your Alex Morgans, your Becky Sauerbrunns, and just stock a team for the Olympics that is largely younger and newer.
That is our show for today. Our producer is Patrick Fort, filling in for Kevin Bendis. To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. And don't forget to subscribe to the show and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. For Joel Anderson and Stefan Fatsis and Vincent Cunningham, author of Great Expectations, I am Josh Levine. Remember Zelma Beatty, and thanks for listening.